The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Belgium is at a crossroads. There have been 6 raids around Brussels today in search of suspected terrorists and ISIS operatives. French prosecutors have confirmed that the Belgian citizen Abdelhamid Abaoud, the architect of the Paris attacks, was killed in that 7-hour police raid at an apartment in the Paris suburb of Saint-Denis earlier this week. What is the Belgian connection here? In the 2 great wars of the 20th century, the Germans' initial act of war with France began with an invasion of Belgium. Belgium overrun by foreign fighters twice in the 20th century. ISIS seems to have refashioned an episode of history by using Belgium as a staging point for attacking France and triggering a wider religious world war. Independent watchdog groups believe hundreds of radicalized Muslims and converts from Belgium have gone to fight with ISIS in Syria and Iraq. The Belgian community of Molenbeek may have become an impenetrable network of radicalism. Mayor Françoise Schepmans admitted that a sizable number of Molenbeek's 100,000 residents are not fully integrated into the country.
Most of the people, even if they lived here, some of them didn't feel like home. It was a problem.
That's the mayor of Molenbeek addressing reporters on Wednesday. Each time there is a link with Molenbeek, Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel said, this is a gigantic problem. Interior Minister Jean Jambon added, we don't have control of the situation in Molenbeek at present. Ambassador Bénédicte Frankenet is the permanent representative of Belgium to the United Nations, and she joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Ambassador.
Hello.
Would you say Belgium has something to answer for in the events from Friday, some issue of assimilation, of culture, of security, anything?
Well, I think we cannot deny that obviously there is an issue and there is a problem. But I think it's also very clear that we have started reacting to these problems already some time ago. The question of integration needs to be addressed. Also, it's very much linked to the perception by second, third generation young people of immigrant origin, but for instance, whose parents were quite well assimilated, about how they perceive that they are not part of the society in which they live. So, yes, the question of integration is an issue, but also the question of how these frustrated young people who maybe did not have a job, who maybe already were part of small criminal gangs, how did they become radicalized? And that's an issue that we have been addressing already since 2005 with the National Plan Against Radicalization. And it has been compounded, of course, by the Syrian conflict itself, which has acted as an attraction to some of these young people by way of active cells in Belgium that were actually recruiting young people on the internet or via radical preachers and have convinced them that this is a fight worth fighting for.
If you know that hundreds of people have gone to ISIS to fight, what are the repercussions of that? Is it simply, you know, see you later, or is there a way of monitoring them in Syria? Are there special protocols in place if they should ever show up again?
No, definitely the idea is both to stop them from going, and we have put a lot of efforts into that part of the issue. It still needs to be completed. It entails more than working alone in Belgium. We need to work together with our European partners. As you know, Europe has external borders. It has a lot of airports. So preventing people from leaving Belgium is one of the issues. The second one is monitoring people who come back. And that has also been done. So we have a very good idea so far, probably still incomplete, about which people left, which people tried to leave and were prevented from leaving, and then which people came back. And some of them have faced, you know, trials and incriminations.
This Mr. Abaoud apparently had a Belgian passport, went to Syria, returned to Belgium. I mean, is that just perceived as there's so many people doing that it would be impossible to find all of them who might have extraordinarily nefarious intents? Or, I mean, wouldn't he be someone who might be on a shorter leash than was the case here?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think we still have many questions first about what happened. We don't know all the facts. We don't know exactly how he came back. He was very much on the radar. And it shows that it is a permanent job to keep improving the tracking, the monitoring, the way we deal with people when they come back. And it's a constant effort. What I can say for sure is that definitely the numbers of people who are trying to leave is now down on a monthly basis, but there are still people leaving Belgium. And of course, the other question, so we will have to work on two tracks. One is, of course, upping all our ways to prevent this type of attacks. And that's a very urgent task that will need to be done also in cooperation with the intelligence services and other specialized instances in the neighboring countries of Belgium. But also what we really need to do in terms of prevention is not only to prevent people from leaving, but to understanding what happens to these young people. Where do they come from? What's happening in their minds?
Well, let's talk about that. Do you have a profile of a radical in Belgium?
I think there are two. I think we mentioned already the possible disenfranchised profile, the people, although they were born in Belgium, who feel that they are not part of society for different reasons, whether it's their own entourage, whether it's because they did not maybe succeed in their studies and didn't find a job at the end of their studies. We cannot deny that, as in many societies, there are some rampant form of discriminations, whether they are conscious or unconscious. But I think what we are also very convinced of is that in Belgium, some very nefarious groups target these young people. We had a major trial employing more than 40 people of a group called Sharia for Belgium, who was actively recruiting young people.
And Sharia for Belgium, yes, the number for Belgium,
exactly.
And it's an online, very active.
Yes. Yeah. So that part of the step going from your daily frustration to becoming an active, violent, radical or extremist fighting a terrorist fight, that is very present in our analysis.
Can you shut down Sharia for Belgium?
Yes, of course. And these people have gone to court and they have been condemned to very heavy jail sentences. But the next thing is to figure out what the attraction can be for these young people and to organize a counter-narrative and fighting them on the role of internet and recruitment via the internet cannot be denied either.
I spoke at the very beginning of our conversation that Belgium was overrun by armies in the First World War and the Second World War in the 20th century. Is there a feeling that Belgium in the 21st century is being overrun by this sense of radicalism and that it is a difficult, if not impossible, problem to manage?
Well, that it is difficult, I think everybody agrees. Difficult to manage because it's new, because it entails so many levels of issues. For instance, as I was mentioning, the international situation itself has created a new, more violent type of terrorist. Before the war in Syria, we had people already leaving for Iraq, but on a much smaller scale. And so maybe people who had become radicalized didn't find an expression to their radicalism into active terrorism for the Islamic State. So I think we cannot ignore the Syria situation. And we also, diplomatically and politically, we really think that we need to put an end to this conflict itself via diplomatic means as well. So we are part of the coalition also fighting Daesh for the moment in Iraq. And all this is part of the equation. So that it is difficult is for sure. That the what happened in Paris and the attack against the Jewish Museum in Brussels last year, all these things have taken people, I think the general population, definitely by surprise and by thinking this is too much. But on the other end, I don't think there is a sense of being overwhelmed. I think people are very conscious about the fact that this is a phenomenon that is tackled by the authorities. There is a strong push from the government to go further. And I think you followed the speech of the Prime Minister in Parliament explaining what extra measures we are going to take. And we are also very conscious that in this fight, we really need to work according to our own values, which is respect for human rights, avoiding some kind of amalgamation between the immigrant population in Belgium, of which 90% is legal.
Ambassador Bénédicte Frankenet is permanent representative of Belgium to the United Nations. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As barbaric as the attacks in Paris and Beirut were by ISIS this month, and there's the publication this week in ISIS's glossy magazine of a taunting picture claiming to be the soda can bomb that brought down the Russian plane over Egypt's Sinai Desert. As barbaric as all that is, consider the Syrian city of Raqqa this week, the ISIS self-proclaimed capital, where it is apparently open season for airstrikes. 33 militants in Syria this week have been killed by airstrikes since last Friday, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a monitoring group. But there have been Russian airstrikes, French airstrikes, British and U.S. airstrikes. In meetings in Washington next week, French President Francois Hollande is expected to press President Obama to increase American support in the fight against ISIS. Noah Bonsi, senior analyst on Syria for the International Crisis Group, is here in the studio. Is there any precedent for one city being a target of all these military air forces, apparently with a loose kind of coordination?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure if there's a precedent. What I am sure of is that the quantity of strikes here is not really what's going to make a difference. And we can say that in general, as we found over the last year of American airstrikes targeting ISIS in Syria and Iraq, is that airstrikes alone are going to be insufficient to make a great deal of difference to fundamentally weaken the organization. So this uptick we've seen coming from all these different directions is not really going to get at the root of the issue, to say the least.
And if you look at the Americans, you say the Americans haven't had much impact. The French are, until now, not the front line of this attack against ISIS. And the British have been involved, but not, again, the major player. The Russians, though, actually have experience doing this. And in Chechnya, they bombed the city of Grozny into a gravel pit. In a sense, that's really the only kind of tactic that's going to work here.
Well, I would disagree with that, actually. I would say that what's proven effective against this organization in the past, and, you know, ISIS, we, you know, is the current embodiment of what we used to call al-Qaeda in Iraq, right? And in 2007, 2008, we saw al-Qaeda in Iraq dramatically reduced in power to the point, to the verge of defeat, not by airstrikes or by brunt foreign military force, but by credible local Sunni Arab forces who, in cooperation with the U.S. military, were able to really sort of town by town dramatically reduce the organization's power and drive it out of towns that it had been completely controlling throughout much of Sunni Iraq. It's the credibility of these local forces that is crucial. This is weakening a group like this cannot be accomplished solely from the air, and it cannot be accomplished by foreign forces, which tend to, you know, both the airstrikes and the presence of foreign forces or foreign forces in the lead on the ground, the civilian casualties that those create tremendously help the narrative of a jihadi group such as the Islamic State, ISIS. And ultimately, the benefit that ISIS gets in recruiting can compensate for whatever immediate material and manpower losses it suffers.
So you see ISIS saying, bring it on with the airstrikes, and Francois Hollande is doing the bidding of ISIS here.
I don't know if I would go quite that far, but let's put it this way. It is not foreign airstrikes that ISIS fundamentally fears. If that was what it was worried about, it would not be conducting these attacks outside of Syrian and Iraqi territory. It clearly knows that these airstrikes will follow. Look, if airstrikes were the answer, the Syrian regime has been conducting brutal, nonstop airstrikes against opposition-held territory, territory held by groups that, for the most part, oppose ISIS, you know, for several years, and this has not fundamentally weakened his armed opposition. In fact, arguably, this opposition has over time increased in power. So it's not about airstrikes. And we should also get to the point that while there's a shared foe here between Russia on one hand and the United States, France, and others, their priorities differ. And Russia's priority is to prop up Bashar Assad's regime, his rule personally, it seems, whereas the United States and others view, correctly I would say, Bashar Assad's brutality in conducting this war and his continued rule as a key source of recruitment for ISIS and ultimately a major part of the problem. So this is why, despite the fact that all of these external forces do indeed oppose the Islamic State and are to some extent striking it, the fact that they have such fundamental disagreement over how to solve the overall problem of Syria helps explain why there's not really significant coordination.
So no coordination. The attacks appear to be more face-saving revenge gestures than they are a coherent attempt to roll back ISIS. And ISIS doesn't appear to be afraid of them at all. Does that sum it up?
I would say that sums it up. And to be fair, this is certainly not an easy problem to address. But one way to put it, and to focus on the United States for a moment, what the United States wants in terms of its policy to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS, as the president has put it, via a military approach that focuses exclusively on that organization, prioritizes that above a serious effort to address the problem of Assad rule in Syria, it's probably not possible to accomplish this goal. Without addressing the problem of Assad rule in Syria and achieving a political transition there that would help get Sunni Arabs in Syria, rebel groups that control much of the country and oppose ISIS, that would encourage them to shift the brunt of their military force against ISIS, that would enable them to do so, because right now they're fighting a two-front war, can only dedicate so much to fighting the Islamic State. Ultimately, you cannot completely separate between these two problems, between the regime problem on the one hand and ISIS on the other. And that's an incredibly difficult policy challenge.
Is the end game here some sort of partition of the region where you have a Sunni state from North Africa to Baghdad, a Kurdish state, and some kind of Shia state involving pieces of Syria and Iran? I don't know what ISIS wants. What are the coalition of forces that are fighting ISIS want?
The coalition of forces fighting ISIS and the warring parties on all sides here accepting ISIS agree that a breakup of the Syrian nation state is not desirable. It's something they all seek to prevent despite their conflicting agendas and priorities. And frankly, if you just look at the map, the demographics of this area, cutting cleanly along those lines is impossible and would create all kinds of problems with displacement and continuing ethnic and sectarian warfare, which would end up continuing to fuel extremism problems moving forward. So there isn't a clean answer here.
And that's maybe precisely what ISIS is exploiting right now. Noah Bonsi is senior analyst on Syria for the International Crisis Group. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The Takeaway has embarked on a year-long exploration of the changing world of community colleges. We've looked at South Dakota's Lake Area Technical Institute that has had great success meeting student needs and community needs for workers and people trying to escape persistent social problems. Community college, is it an affordable alternative for students and a solution to community economic and social ills? The answer to that is only maybe. Nearly a million community college students don't have access to the federal student loan program geared toward traditional four-year colleges. And with student loan defaults climbing, some communities see one social problem being replaced by another, insolvency. Joshua Cohen is an attorney and founder of the StudentLoanLawyer.com. Joshua, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thank you.
Are community college students in a particular bind here regarding indebtedness, defaults, and their lack of access to low-interest loans?
Well, I think there's a problem not having access to federal loans because they're so much more friendlier than a private loan.
How much advance warning do community college students get, both to their lack of access to federal student loans and to the fact that the wiggle room and margin for error is pretty narrow, depending on when they leave school and the circumstances of keeping their grades up, that sort of thing?
I'm not sure they're given any warning. From what I hear from clients, they don't realize what they have until school is long gone.
Do you think, in general, community colleges are fundamentally different than the four-year colleges? I guess they have more time because they're in college for 4 years. A two-year school means you're starting your payments much more quickly.
It does. And the other concern is with the federal loan, when they move on to that four-year college, there's an automatic deferral. With the private loan, they should get a deferral, but it burns the amount of time that they have when they finish that four-year degree, if they finish the four-year degree. There's also the idea that when you're going to community college, you're expecting to continue on. When you go to a four-year college, you're expecting to graduate with a bachelor's, and that in itself is a different mindset for the student.
What advice would you give community college students in terms of trying to make their college experience more affordable? Because most people think of community college as an alternative that is more affordable.
It should be more affordable when we're looking at the price tag. When it comes to student loans, the federal student loans are the same whether they go to a community college or a four-year. As a freshman, they can have $3,500 in Stafford loans. As a sophomore, they get, I believe it's $4,500. But the private loan could be anything. I've seen people with the private loan for a freshman year of $20,000. So it should be cheaper at a community college.
And the interest rates on a loan that high?
Interest rates are based on credit, and most folk I know who are just starting in college don't have credit, which is why they rope in the parent. I've seen interest rates anywhere from 4 to 14%.
14%. That's extraordinary. So the lack of access to federal loans can actually erase the on-paper price tag, sticker price advantage that community colleges have over four-year colleges in terms of affordability.
That's exactly it. I mean, in the end, it's like buying a car. You want the best rate possible. It doesn't really matter what dealer you get it from.
Does this vary in region around the country? Are there particular community colleges that are hip to this problem and can help students? What should consumers look for?
What consumers should be looking for is when they get their financial aid award letter from whatever school they're going to, be sure that the loans on there are federal loans. Does it say Stafford? Does it say Parent Plus Loan? And when in doubt, ask the financial aid advisor.
Joshua Cohen is an attorney and founder of thestudentloanlawyer.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film Brooklyn, starring Saoirse Ronan, about a young Irish woman torn between life and love in her native country and her new home in New York. Now playing.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. And you might say my life can be summed up with this song.
I'm traveling in some vehicle. I'm sitting in some cafe.
Then this song.
You walked in and my life began again.
And finally pay it off with this tune.
She dreams in color. She dreams in red. Can't find a better man.
That's my life in three songs. Great ideas you can either envy or just rip off. And it was Tony Sarabia's idea, the host of WBEZ's Morning Shift in Chicago, to have listeners pick three songs to do their bio. We were going to do something about it together when I was in Chicago on Monday, but this week kind of got away from us, you know? We can still ask you for your three-song bio, though, or the three anthems of your life.
Hi, this is Sarah from Grays Lake, Illinois, and my three songs are 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton for my office job as a legislator's aide.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by.
Revolution by the Beatles, to never forget my upbringing of my grandparents and my parents speaking out for change. And Boro Boro by Persian artist Arash, to get in touch with my Persian heritage.
I love this one from Royal Oak, Michigan, Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, because my dad and grandfather sailed the Great Lakes were actually on Lakes the day she went down. This song makes me feel closer to them now that they're gone.
Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling?
House of the Rising Sun, again for my dad. He tried to escape his demons in New Orleans. They caught up.
And it's been the ruin of many a poor boy. In God, I know I'm one.
Finally, happy. Because despite all the trials and tribulations, love's gained and love's lost, I'm still happy.
Sunshine, she's here. You can take a break. I'm a hot air balloon that could go to space.
Montrose, Colorado. I only need one. Johnny Cash's I've Been Everywhere. I've traveled a lot, seen a lot, and the ride is not over.
I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man.
Hi, this is Pat from Medina, Ohio. In My Life, Blackbird, and This Land Is Your Land, that about sums it up.
There are places I remember.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
This land is your land.
This is Angela Sims from Chicago, Illinois.
Ain't funny that the way you feel shows on your face.
On Your Face by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Living my life like it's golden. Living my life like it's golden. Living my life like it's golden.
Living My Life Like It's Golden by Jill Scott. And Walk On by Faith.
We can all see in the future.
They really have been a template for my life and provide joy to also bless others.
And let's end on some heroic drama from one of our friends in the Lone Star State.
Hi, this is Cheryl from Arlington, Texas. It would probably be to dream the impossible dream. Climb every mountain and you'll never walk alone.
To try when your arms are too weary.
Climb every mountain.
Your life in three songs. Come on, you can do it. Some Grateful Dead songs are a life. All the better. 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. Mitch Albom has been a lot of things. A sports reporter, a writer, a publishing phenomenon, more than 35 million copies of his books in circulation. But Albom really wanted to be a songwriter. This was going to be his big hit.
Pleasure and pain. There's a fine line between pleasure and pain, and we spend most of our lives crossing it and crossing back over again. And I just thought, well, this has got to work, and didn't.
Not quite. Album's big hit would be a book, the 1997 publication of Tuesdays with Morrie, which settled the question of what he was going to be when he grew up. But music is still there.
Go away.
Keyboards, Mitch Albom is playing in the all-writer Rock Bottom Remainders garage band. His new book, The Magic Strings of Frankie Presto, is about the legends of music he's met and admired and the ones he's imagined being a long time ago, all brought to life through the magic of writing and the magic of music.
I was a musician before I was a writer, and I had every intention of staying one. I lived over in Europe for a while, played music and sang, and then I came over here to New York and tried to make it as a singer-songwriter and flopped. And it was only in the failing of that that I sort of volunteered for a local newspaper that they were given out for free in the supermarkets. And I volunteered for it. I wrote a story for it. Well, if music's not going to work out, this is creative, and maybe I can steer some of the energy into that. So for the next 30 years or more, I basically stayed away from ever writing about music, even though it had been my passion in my life.
But you create a familiar music god who speaks to us all.
Yeah, the narrator of The Magic Strings of Frankie Presto is music itself. And it begins at his funeral when music itself comes to take back all the talent that Frankie Presto took from it. And so he comes to take it back to sprinkle over the souls of newborn children. And while he's there at the funeral, he's so proud of Frankie Presto, his creation, that he decides to stay at the funeral and listen to the stories that everybody else tells about him. And meanwhile, he also tells the stories. But being able to speak as the voice of music was great because it's such a different voice. It's not a first person of a real character, which is limited to the personality of that character. It's not a third person, narrator in which you just kind of have to state what happened. You get to be music.
You know, there's this universality that comes out of this idea of music. I mean, even if you suck, you still have the experience, just like if you're, Yo-Yo Ma, of channeling some force when you're playing music. It's not about the quality. It's about how it takes a hold of your heart. And you must have had that experience.
Totally. And I very much had the experience being much less than Yo-Yo Ma also. But it's the feeling of being able to communicate ideas or feelings without using words, that you can express yourself, but it doesn't have to come with anything verbal. And I think wherever you go, you can take two people from anywhere on the planet and you play She Loves You, Yeah, 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 and both of their feet start tapping. There's something very magical and very universal in the human spirit about that. And one of the themes of the book, one of the reasons I wanted to write it, was because having been in many bands in my life, I recognized that the way a band works is the way, like, the bands in life work. Your family, your workplace, there's always a lead guitar kind of guy, and then there's the steady drum beat guy, and then there's the one who wants to be out front, and then there's the background singers who really kind of want to be out front. All those personalities that kind of go on within a band repeat over and over again in your life. So another, philosophy of the book is everybody joins a band in this life. Some of them play music.
In my family, my 17-year-old and my 14-year-old daughters are the two lead singers.
Right.
I'm background everything.
Totally. Okay.
My son is drummer.
Okay.
And
steady.
My little son, my 5-year-old, is, we kind of don't know what he is. He could be keyboards.
Yeah.
But
might
my wife is ukulele for sure.
Okay.
My wife is ukulele for sure.
See? So there you go. So that's your band.
Yeah.
And everybody has one. Everybody joins one. And the way that we affect one another within it is the magic both of a musical band and also of a human band.
So Frankie Presto, he's not necessarily a happy camper, but boy, can he play the guitar.
Yeah. He is that marriage of the tragic musician. He's an orphan from literally the day he's born. His mother dies. He's born in a burning church in Spain during the Civil War. And the last thing she does is hum a melody into his ear, Lagrima, which is a classical piece by Francisco Torrega. She hums this melody in his ear and then she dies. And he's sort of left out on his own. And all these tragic things happen to him. He's thrown away as a baby into the river. He almost dies there. And then a dog pulls him out. He's saved by a man who then has to go to prison. And a blind guitar teacher takes him over and influences him. That's
classics.
Not an accident.
I mean, you got Moses in there. You got Tiresias in
totally.
There. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, but it's meant to show how many people it sort of takes to raise a kid in this world. So anyhow, he bounces through with this. And as a result of the suffering that he's gone through, he's granted this guitar with 6 magic strings when he's about 9 years old. And the secret of the strings is that he can actually use them to change people's lives.
Tuesdays with Maury was a great experience for you. It was also a bit of a surprise for you, the way that it caught on. What of that experience, the Tuesdays with Maury experience, the writing, the mentorship, and then the subsequent fame, produced lessons that we find in this book?
You know, since I wrote that book, which was never intended to be what it became, I mean, it's so far from it. It was meant to be a tiny little book that paid his medical bills. But I've had people actually come up to me and say, Tuesdays with Maury changed my life. And, you know, I'm always very gracious. Oh, thank you. But I hear that enough. At first I thought, oh, come on, it's a book. But having heard that so many times, it sort of became the foundation for this Frankie Presto book because he's given a gift that can actually change lives. And I've come to believe that it's actually true, not in the sense like I read Tuesdays with Maury and everything in my life before that was worthless and now it makes you take a right turn. It makes you think about something a little bit differently than you did before. It makes you view something a little bit differently than you did before. If you're a kid and you hear somebody play music so well that you say to yourself, that's what I want to do, then your life was changed by one song or one way that somebody played. And so I took that conceit and that kind of got woven into this book as well.
You dedicate the book to the first person who you wanted to play like,
My uncle.
Yeah?
Yeah. First person who made me say, I want to sound like that. And there's always somebody who makes you say, I want to sound like that. You know, teach me how to play the guitar like that.
Mitch Albom, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mitch Albom is a best-selling author. His new novel is The Magic Strings of Frankie Presto, out this month. And here's something to take with you today. Think of it as a little gift from us, a little relief from the turmoil on this planet. Well, the Large Binocular Telescope and the Magellan Adaptive Optics System in Arizona has found, according to University of Arizona scientists, for the very first time, one or two planets in the process of actually being born. Fuzzy little blobs in the middle of an orbit around a star. 430 light years away from Earth. Shall we warn these little planets what they have to look forward to about 4 or 5 billion years from now? All the things that are coming their way? Nah. Let them find out on their own. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at thetakeaway.org. And you can ask me anything on Twitter every day at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.